Thank you for downloading this episode in the Harm Reduction Coalition podcast series. My name is Alan Clear and I work for the Harm Reduction Coalition. This week I'm talking to Rebecca Tiger. And Rebecca, who I met in New York a long time ago when she was at the New York Academy of Medicine, she's a professor of sociology up at Middlebury College, which I think is in Vermont. And she has a book out called Judging Addicts, Drug Courts and Coercion in the Justice System. So we spent quite a bit of time talking about drug courts and breaking them down. And one of the things that I use foul language or dirty language or language I wouldn't normally use, in this episode. We use the term addicts all the way through. And I did that. And I guess we both did it because the book is called Judging Addicts and we use that as a starting point. And actually right towards the end, we sort of break that down a little bit too. But just for those people who get really annoyed about that kind of thing, you will be annoyed all the way through. But it's a great interview and I really enjoy talking to Rebecca. So here we are in drug courts. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Alan.
We're going to break down drug courts a bit.
Great.
Yeah, you have a book out, Judging Addicts.
Yes.
So you have gone into this quite in depth. Let's just actually start by explaining what drug courts are, who's eligible for them, etc.
Oh my, I have to go back and review the book. So drug courts are called an alternative sentencing model, and so they're a vehicle through which people who are identified as addicts who have been charged. Usually with a criminal offense, are mandated to drug treatment instead of prison. And so it's judicially monitored drug treatment, which occasionally they are incarcerated, but incarceration becomes kind of a treatment tool if they're, for instance, if they have drugs in their urine or things like that. But it's considered an alternative sentencing model.
And who would be eligible to be put into a drug court system?
So that would depend somewhat on the jurisdiction. There are actually misdemeanor and felony, although the misdemeanor drug courts, from what I understand, aren't that popular. It's a drug or drug-related charge. Mm-hmm. And so it's someone who has been in some ways identified as it's been identified that addiction is the reason for their criminal offense.
So like shoplifting or something would get you into a drug court, but maybe would domestic violence or violence get into a drug court?
Well, they do actually have domestic violence courts, so I don't know about that. Violence wouldn't because of I think there's a few drug courts, but if you get federal, there's something about the funding that you can't take people who have a violent offense.
Right.
So it's nonviolent offenses.
Yeah, because there's an element of cherry picking as well.
Yes.
When it comes to drug courts, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that's been one of the critiques of them, is that they sort of pick people who they kind of think are going to succeed in drug treatment to begin with. And mm-hmm. so they're sort of screening out people who they feel like might take multiple attempts at drug treatment to get, quote, clean. And people within the drug court field, some of them are critical of that sort of cherry picking. So it's not just people outside of it. I think some drug court advocates think that the courts shouldn't be doing the cherry picking.
Yeah, and I guess the cherry picking has a dual function, right? Cherry picking is so that they pick the people most likely to succeed, but they also pick the people most likely to succeed so that drug courts look really good.
Yes, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of, that's I think one critique of them, so that their data looks mm-hmm. good. And they have a habit, I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is I go through some of the bigger evaluations of drug courts. And you know, the outcomes are actually really mixed, but mm-hmm. in a small percentage of cases, people actually end up spending more time incarcerated than if they had just bypassed drug court because of the jail as a treatment tool, or called flash incarceration, when things aren't working with treatment, and then they eventually fail out of the drug court, and then they have a certain sentence awaiting them because they've pled guilty to a felony offense or something like that. And so It's hard in some ways to evaluate success of drug courts, and I think the advocates, of course, overplay the success. But there's a subset of people for whom it's been worse for them.
Yeah, and there's a set of people that actually this works for as well, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, actually, a couple people came over yesterday to the book signing. I mean, they talked about it they said that they really drug courts. Well, one guy had been in two. One didn't work, and then he was in another one, and that he said it was really great, and it did work for him. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some people, you know, their testimony, they'll say This saved my life. The judge is the only person who's ever cared about me, et cetera, et cetera. So there are people who really loved it.
Yeah. And it is, if you look at federal promotion of systems at work, one of them is drug courts. And, mm-hmm. and in the same way that we've exported the war on drugs
yeah.
globally, we're now trying to export drug courts
yeah.
as a solution.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people would look at drug courts as, well, you know, surely it's better than prison.
Yeah, that's what people say.
Yeah, but we haven't explored this very much. But mm-hmm. I don't get how, you know, let's take certain premises that the people that say drug courts are really effective mm-hmm. are saying you shouldn't put people, that addiction is a disease, and mm-hmm. you shouldn't put, and I would say if addiction is a disease, why are they involved in the criminal justice system
yeah.
at all?
Well, the thing that I noticed, so for my book, I interviewed a lot of people who were sort of national advocates of drug courts. I was interested in the way they were framing their arguments. And so the practice of drug courts, my argument is that it's predicated on a sort of dominant ideological belief about addiction. And so I was interested in where that was coming from. I mean, the drug court advocates, a lot of them are legal folks. So they don't come,
yeah.
they're not treatment people who decided to come into criminal justice policy. There are people who have been involved in criminal justice policy who want to reform it from the inside. So their perspective, for them to say, this is actually not a criminal justice issue at all, would be such a leap. I can't really imagine it happening. The second thing is that many of the people I interviewed don't believe that the criminal justice system doesn't have a place. They believe the criminal justice system does have a place in curing the, quote, disease of addiction. And they don't see drug courts as a step towards eventually getting the criminal justice system out of the control of drug users as sick people. They actually will say, and I talk about this in my book, that drug courts saved us from decriminalization. We were going down that route, and drug courts saved us.
Right.
Drug court is a middle way. Drug court says, listen, there are some people who are sick, but who will not commit to treatment unless they're forced to, and that's the benefit. And so if you actually see drug court, people were very pivotal and sort of very vocal, I should say, in their opposition to, you know, what is it, Prop 36 in California,
yeah.
which would sort of take people out of the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
They were very vocal against it because it's not true that they think, that they just believe that prison isn't the right place for addicts. They actually believe the right place is judicially monitored drug treatment. And they will say jail is crucial as a treatment tool, the sanction of jail. And so without that, they think that drug court is basically useless. Treatment is useless. So they're really advocating very strongly a particular viewpoint that coerced treatment is better than not just jail, but that coerced treatment is better than voluntary treatment.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of their work, is to get people to understand it that way.
How do they... When you question them and query them on that if addiction is a disease,
mm-hmm.
that somehow you can beat people with a stick,
mm-hmm.
And they would also say, you know, sugar them with a carrot.
Yeah,
I guess,
they do
right,
carrot
yeah.
and stick. They say that a lot.
Yeah, but that you should punish people if they don't
yeah.
respond to the drug courts or the judge's wishes.
Yeah.
In managing their disease, a disease
yeah.
apparently that they actually do have real control over, but it's a disease, so you actually don't.
Yeah.
How do they break that down?
Well, my sense from the interviews was that drug court people don't, and again, there's so many of them, there's a variety of them, but again, I spoke with people who are sort of really part of articulating the drug court movement. They don't necessarily fully believe, I don't believe, that addiction is a disease. They understand that has gained traction,
mm-hmm.
and that there's a cultural that sort of resonates in a culture that thinks of itself in terms of disease, a very medicalized culture, but that it's really complicated. I mean, one person I interviewed said, you know, I said, so how can you justify coercing someone into treatment if they're sick, and especially treatment that's overseen by a judge? And he said, you know, the idea that we shouldn't coerce people into treatment is, he said, that's a kind of liberal sort of philosophical standpoint. It's not practical. The practical thing is that sometimes you have to force people to get better. And we know you have to because they're breaking the law. And that's fundamentally the issue.
Right.
They're breaking the law. And so they have, in essence, given up their right to either keep using drugs or to go to treatment voluntarily. They've sort of given that right up. So now we're going to make them get sober.
Do many of the people you talk to actually, because I mean, I've taken the premise that the dominant society and dominant approach to this is addiction is a disease, and we're going to help cure these people. Mm-hmm. Do any of them actually just say, "No, that's bullshit," and actually we can manage their drug problem through this, and we don't actually really believe it's a disease. It's just a manageable problem that if we just beat them up a bit or help them a bit, it will cure them.
Yeah, there's one woman who's actually written quite a bit about this, Sally Satel, is a...
She was sort of an evil woman a while ago. She's still... where is she in the pantheon now?
Well, she's actually moved on to different issues. I think she's taken up... actually, her issue is organ transplants. I haven't followed her, but I think she might be at American Enterprise. She's at a think tank. She's a psychiatrist.
Yeah, she used to be really anti-needle exchange as well.
She
was a pain in the ass.
She's the person. So I was originally going to call my book Force is the Best Medicine, but my publisher felt like people wouldn't get that there was irony in that. That's a quote actually from Sally Satel. It's from, I think, an editorial that she wrote maybe in the New York Times. The New York Times loves drug courts, and so every so often they sort of rehash how great they are. They're really a perfect sort of liberals kind of intervention. So she has come out and said, addiction.
A liberal's intervention. It's funny you say that because it feels like it isn't to me. I guess maybe I'm an extreme.
I'm a radical.
Okay,
radical.
Good. I was going to say extreme liberal. I don't like that label.
I think that, you know, there was a great. I sort of start the book talking about this article. I think that Newsweek refers to drug courts as a kind of this quote near vanishing thing in Washington, an issue with consensus. So when you have an issue that with consensus, you actually know you're in the presence of something really. And when I use the word hegemonic, but something really dominant. If both sides, right, if generals under, you know, the Bush administration and rock stars, now Matthew Perry from Friends is the sort of celebrity spokesperson for drug courts. If all those people can agree, you know you're in the presence of something, some really powerful force, and that's this real firm belief in sort of narratives of addiction, recovery, redemption, et cetera. There's actually a very moralistic. This is where, you know, in the book I trace the kind of emergence of the disease model of addiction, and I go back sort of, you know, 200 years to look at how did we start thinking of habitual substance use as this thing called addiction and then this thing as a disease. But really it's the discourse has always been laced with morality. So it's never, you know, there's people who write about levels of medicalization. It's never been fully medicalized. Fully medicalized would mean we believe it's a disease and it's treated in a doctor's office and that happens at the interactional level, that the sick person meets with a doctor and the doctor prescribes treatment. It's never been fully medicalized. It's more a conceptual medicalization that we talk about it in disease framework, but doctors aren't giving the treatment and, you know, that there's some ambiguity. But so...
That goes back to sort of a liberal desire again to like move it from one place to another by making it sort of more friendly by let's call it a disease.
Yeah, making it more friendly, and then we feel better about the sort of, you know, again, so the critical jail is a treatment tool. You know, I'm going to throw you in jail for the weekend to remind you of your commitment to sobriety, and it's a kind of tough love thing, right? And this is what the drug court people say. So it's a sort of tough love thing, and I guess I say sort of like a liberal intervention because it's done in for your own good, because we know that being sober is sort of in your best interest, and I'm not saying that it's not in some people's best interest.
Yeah.
I'm not actually weighing in, but so Sally Satel is one of the few people who said it's really not. She doesn't think addiction's a disease. I mean, she's actually said in various places it's a character flaw, that these people are sort of like, there's something wrong with them characterologically, and so the point of forcing them into treatment is just to get them behaviorally in line with kind of mainstream society.
Right.
Which is in some ways a more
honest
approach.
Yeah,
I was going to say that. It's more straightforward. She doesn't actually, I don't think, really likes addicts, but she does think that they need to learn how to, you know, not piss their boss off, learn how to be a better, you know, husband, wife, father, mother, sister, that's what they need to learn.
Yeah.
And that they're always going to be there's always going to be a flaw with them, but that coercing them into treatment will sort of get them behaviorally in line, which is actually very consistent with sort of what we do in punishment in general, which is to get people to act in accordance with dominant values.
That's
we don't really care what they think so much as that they act in the way we want them to.
Yeah, in some ways you could take her position to a certain extreme where she wants actually people to be really good drug users.
Maybe, yeah. Or yeah, exactly. Figure out how to do it and not get in trouble when they're doing it.
Yeah, not annoy people.
Not annoy people, yeah. She doesn't say that, but you're right. No. You could sort of see it as, you know, just figure out how to use the drugs and not get in trouble, mm-hmm. not be a public nuisance with it.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the HOPE program?
Mm-mm, no.
Then we can't have a discussion about that, can we?
Well, what is it?
It's one of the things that, it's a program that ONDCP is very fond of. Because they talk about the evaluation is in, they show that it works in reducing recidivism. It's in Hawaii.
It's coerced abstinence.
Yeah.
That's the Mark Kleiman. Mark Kleiman's been involved in evaluations.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They guarantee you'll be back inside a jail cell if you test positive within 20 minutes.
I think it's a really, that's a really interesting, so that gets rid of the treatment. It's just coerced abstinence. Uh-huh. This is going to seem unrelated, but when I was speaking with the head of the company that makes this gram, right, the alcohol mm-hmm. monitoring
right.
anklet, I said to him, you know, you're doing something really interesting with addiction because you're basically saying, and that's for alcoholism, and they really, they talk a lot about how some of the people who are outfitted with scram for drunk driving offenses have been heavy committed drinkers for decades. Mm-hmm. And he said, the amazing thing is you strap a scram on them and they stop drinking. And they don't need recovery. Going to AA might be helpful in addition, but mm-hmm. the primary motivator is the scram and knowing that they'll go to jail if they drink. So he said the treatment world's very angry about things like scram because it sort of says we don't need you. We just need we need this technology. We need the threat of prison, which is what the coerced abstinence stuff is. So the idea is that people don't, in some ways they commit a crime, they've given up their right to be able to alter their consciousness, so they have to just stay abstinent, mm-hmm. And they'll be arrested. There's no treatment, and it's transforming, I think, kind of what people understand the function of treatment is. I mean, it's essentially saying you don't need treatment, you need the threat of prison to get people to stop.
Yeah, I mean, it's that link of, it's a surveillance system, mm-hmm. it's punishment, it's,
yeah.
What would you do in... Let's agree that drug courts are problematic.
Okay.
In their
sure.
Book.
I mean, I've written about that.
Well, yeah. That's
yeah.
Yeah. What? How would you? Would you just get rid of them? Let them die? Because there is a potential that they can die out.
Yeah.
What do you think the future of drug courts should be? It's a weird question.
Yeah.
Play with that.
Okay, yeah, I would play with that. I mean, I talk about this in my book's conclusion, and I know in some ways the conclusion, it was interesting when I was writing the book, I put a pretty strong conclusion where I really, you know, I talk about harm reduction, I talk about legalization, et cetera, et cetera. One person who reviewed it said, love this, it's really strong, powerful, but more in. Another person said, this is totally inappropriate for an academic book. But I felt like I couldn't write this critique and then not sort of show my cards mm-hmm. in some ways.
Yeah.
Because I think that's only fair also to the drug
part of
people.
The book is your transformation too from the very beginning.
Yeah.
How because you were new, I first met you when you New York Academy of Medicine
yeah. mm-hmm.
years ago.
Yeah. that was a long time ago.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, and I remembered riding in the subway and reading this story and just feeling sort of like my, you know, tears in my, like, I wasn't sobbing, but I was like, oh, I was really, you know, my heart was warmed by a story of a drug court judge fixing this, you know, this long-term addict's life and caring for him and tough love, and it just seemed like, but now I know generally when I have a response like that, I know I'm in the presence of some sort of dominant ideology, and I usually try to pick it apart. So what's going on that, and I really started to sort of transform my thinking about drug courts, mm-hmm. and then I started to see them, especially reading the history and going back to the progressive era and hearing about these, which was historically where the emergence of the idea that courts could both help and punish people at the same time.
Right. Can you give the example of juvenile courts?
Yeah,
because that really was helpful. I mean, it was a great piece of the book as well.
Thanks.
I like the book. I should plug the book actually.
Great.
Yeah.
So juvenile courts are in some ways the most to me the real parallel. So juvenile courts were invented, you know, roughly during the progressive era, but the important aspect of juvenile courts was the invention of the idea of the juvenile delinquent. Barry Feld has a book called Bad Kids that really goes into this, and it's important to understand that you know, childhood is a social construction. We haven't always had the category of child. Juvenile delinquent was made by progressive era reformers to describe a certain child, which was, as Barry Feld says, usually someone else's child, other people's children. These were middle class white reformers who were really anxious about immigration, about migration of African Americans from the South. And so what juvenile courts did was really, It was based on this idea of parens patriae, that the state was going to be the sort of substitute parent for these wayward kids whose own parents weren't giving them the proper values. And so kids could be arrested for things like truancy. They could be arrested for just hanging out on the street. They could be arrested for things like smoking cigarettes. But it wasn't really called arrest because this wasn't framed within a sort of criminal framework, although what would happen is kids would get into the juvenile court and they could be under the supervision of the court for years. Oftentimes they were sent upstate, the idea of sort of pastoral, you know, going to a nice kind of pastoral outdoorsy reformatory. They were often sent to reformatories. And so the fundamental idea of juvenile courts was that the state could both punish and help at the same time. And there was no protection for juveniles. I mean, this got overturned, I think it was the late 60s was the In re Galt was the big case, but it wasn't viewed as an adversarial system, so juveniles didn't get representation.
That's right, yeah.
They
basically had no control over anything.
They had no control.
No rights, no control.
But the idea was, well, why should they have them? Because the state cares for them. And the idea was that the state, of course, couldn't go wrong. And so a huge parallel with drug courts is, of course, this invention of the addict. We need to have a sort of robust concept that there is something called an addict. And then we have to have this idea that the courts can help and punish at the same time. And then, and one of the things with many drug courts is that they call them participants, clients. They kind of give up their right to defend themselves in an adversarial way in order to sort of participate in this kind of healing function of the court. So there's this concept of the drug court team. Everyone's sort of there working on behalf of the addict.
The addict, the center of this, is sort of missing in terms of their own representation. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, it doesn't happen, and to sort of go back to what I was saying about the juvenile court, one of the reasons that the addict's voice wouldn't really be represented is because the idea, much like with the juveniles, in the juvenile courts was juveniles aren't able to take care of themselves. And we do have this belief, and certainly the neuroscience of adolescence tells us this, that young people aren't able to think consequentially, they don't understand sort of the importance of their actions, so they have to be guided to make the right choices. So much similarly, the addict has been rendered, because of their drug use, kind of unable to make choices for themselves, so the adults around them have to make those choices. And often when I interviewed drug court advocates, they would say addicts are like children. And they don't mean in the good way, because when we sometimes say, oh, someone's childlike, we might mean that as a positive thing, but they actually mean it as a kind of critique of childhood in some ways. But the idea is that the addicts can't think for themselves, so people have to come in and think for them. I mean, one thing that is true is that, you know, people can come in and say, I don't like the treatment program I'm in. But often that becomes framed as, well, that's because they don't want to face recovery. So the addict's not part of that team deciding what's the best course of action. If they come in with a positive urine, they don't get to decide what should happen to them. The court decides for them, and that's usually decided behind the scenes.
When we say court, it's one person, isn't it? It's just the judge.
Well, there's actually a treatment team, which is made up of criminal justice folks, a treatment person, it's supposed to be a clinical person. And what they do is they actually review in most drug courts, they review the day's kind of docket. They review what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And they have conversations and they decide. They sort of decide so that when the person comes before the judge, what's going to happen to them has already, in essence, been decided by that team. And so I think James Nolan and others have written about drug court as a kind of theater. And really the judge might be stern or do certain things, and they're sort of performing both for the defendant but also for other people in the court who are watching. But it's already been decided by the drug court team sort of what kind of sanctions the person's going to face if they haven't adhered to the program protocol.
Yeah, we're going to go back to the question of what would you see in this place, but it's I haven't interacted that much with drug court people. I've interacted with West Huddleston. right? From he's the, I guess, executive director of the Drug Court Professionals, or whatever that organization's called.
Yeah, National Association of Drug Court Professionals.
Yeah, National Association of Drug Court Professionals. I like him.
Mm-hmm.
I actually respond to him.
Mm-hmm.
He is warm and compassionate,
yeah,
right? And then I've come across judges who annoy the shit out of me.
Yeah.
I can't believe that they say the things they do. Yeah. But they're also sort of have this zealous belief that what they're doing is transforming people's lives. And I think that's what I find disgusting, is that these people have so much control over someone else's life, and they're fixing them through their brilliance or whatever.
Yeah.
What was your reaction talking to people who are very much involved in implementing drug court system?
You know, it's funny, when I reread my book, you know, I wrote this a while ago, and then it goes through editing, and then, of course, like, it's hard to read your own work, much like I'm probably not going to listen to this because it's hard to listen to your voice, but I found that, you know, West Huddleston, for example, is, I mean, he will talk about the gospel of drug court. He is a firm believer. I mean, he believes it. The people believe it. The interesting thing to me always has been how the ideology of addiction filters into people's consciousness and what they think they should do about it. So again, if addiction is a disease, why is a judge in charge of treatment?
Yeah.
I remember asking, I was at a big National Association of Drug Court Professionals conference, and I asked a woman who is the head of the treatment aspect of a drug court, of a large drug court in Louisiana. I said, what training did you have in addiction? And she said, I had an alcoholic father, that's all I needed to know.
Right.
So that a lot of people who run drug courts believe they know addiction. In fact, you could sort of take an average person on the street, and they will say they know what an addict is. They've probably diagnosed someone as an addict. Most of us have. I have diagnosed people as addicts. And that they feel like they know. And that's where I think the danger in this is. And this is where Ira Glass's This American Life, that was devoted to a particular drug court. I think it was in Kentucky. I don't remember.
I think it was, wasn't it Atlanta, around Georgia somewhere?
Maybe, in Georgia. Yeah. And this drug court judge who had unimaginable control over people was locking them in jail for undefined periods of time, cutting off communication between them and their families.
Yeah, putting them in solitary without psych meds.
Yes, putting them in solitary without psych meds. I mean, this one woman talks about an experience where she wanted to kill herself because she was just sort of being indefinitely detained. To me, that is the danger of drug court, and that often gets dismissed. I was talking to one drug court advocate who said, well, that's bad drug court practice. In fact, let's not even call that drug court, but that is drug court.
Yeah.
And because of the power that the judge is given, much like in the juvenile courts in the progressive era, the power that the judge is given can really sort of undo any potential therapeutic benefit there might have been from the court.
Yeah. So where would you go with this?
Well, one thing I wanted to say about that This American Life piece that I think is important is even Ira Glass, it's an hour-long program. It highlights two people and sort of the way in which this drug court really just fucked with them. And yet, he starts off the piece saying, drug courts are really good. We know it. This is a bad judge. He has that, again, that sort of liberal perspective that this is a really important innovation. There are going to be some bad apples, this judge. Let's just get rid of her, but keep drug court and save it. He can't see that it's something fundamental to the drug court model that allows this kind of judicial behavior. So what, you know, the way I see sort of what to do is both a sort of philosophical, maybe partly academic enterprise, and it's also a practical policy one. I mean, to me, you know, the issue with drug courts, like I said, is that drug court advocates say that we're saving us from decriminalization because they're saying not only is drug court better than jail, but drug court's better than voluntary treatment. They're trying to sort of enter into the discussion on treatment. I think that that's a real problem, because what that's essentially saying is we have to keep criminalization intact. We just have to change what we do to people once we criminalize them. And so I think, you know, a strong I would say legalization, some people say decriminalization movement is important at the same time. But secondly, my issue or my concern is really sort of conceptualizing how we think about and understand addiction and addicts. And we live in a country where we let people get so vulnerable that in some ways, some people, that that criminal behavior is really the only option. Adding to that, that we've also criminalized increasing aspects of human life, so that we sort of create the conditions that then make it so that people will be arrested and then swept up in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and kept in the system for the rest of their lives.
And kept in the system because of various ways in which they're monitored. So, so that I would say that we need a sort of, in some ways, a radical sort of reorientation of how we think about these things. And I know that in some ways that sounds kind of implausible, but I also feel like as an academic, it's not my job to propose a sort of, well, here's let's just keep drug courts but make drug court judges nicer. That to me would not be consistent with what I found when I did this historical aspect of my research. But I think in a broader perspective, again, using the history, and I use a lot of David Rothman's books. He wrote about the invention of prison, and he also wrote about progressive era reforms, is that he found that, you know, ultimately the same institution that punishes can't heal, that they're diametrically opposed, and that punishment ends up being the dominant framework and the healing function goes out. And I would predict that that's going to happen with drug courts. So even no matter what I think about drug courts, I think they're going to go through that historical cycle where they sort of go back to the dominant tendency of the system, which is towards punishment. And so ultimately, I think it's part of a bigger framework of rethinking what is this thing called addiction, and what should we do about it?
Yeah, so essentially, it's a balancing act in these drug courts is a balancing act between, the criminal end, the criminal justice end, mm-hmm. and the healing end, mm-hmm. and that ultimately it cannot but end up in the criminal justice part of it and diminish the healing end. I mean, I would tend to agree with what you say. If we look at the other aspect is what we call treatment as well.
Well,
yeah.
That's what I wanted to say, because in the U.S., much drug treatment is punitive. I mean, it is. You just told a story about this, your neighbor going across the street and being kicked out of a program after 23 days of a 30-day program. That kind of punitive mentality. I mean, you know, you hear stories about therapeutic communities which really sort of turn people against each other, make them spy on each other. They break people down, tell them how they're so pathological, all their desires are perverse, so that. Of course, given sort of our development of an addiction ideology in the U.S., we also have a treatment ideology that in some ways is not that different than punishment, mm-hmm. which is why these two come together so smoothly. So I'm not arguing that if we somehow take it, whatever that is, out of the hands of the criminal justice system, that all of a sudden people will go into drug treatment and things will be great. Much drug treatment is abstinence-oriented and it's extremely punitive. So, you know, I would also argue for a reframing. And sort of moving away from believing abstinence is somehow better morally.
Yeah.
I don't see any reason to think that. And it's very hard for some people to maintain as well.
I mean, there's a lot to this. We could carry on talking about this, but the book is great. I really enjoyed the book.
Thank
I don't know
much.
Why more has not been done around critiquing drug courts, but.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is I think that one of the reasons there's not a lot of critique of drug court is, you know, what I call this hegemonic or dominant way of thinking about addiction. So to question, you know, oftentimes we will say, well, what should we do then? And my question I sort of pose back is, well, what should we do about what? And
mm-hmm.
ultimately
yeah.
my book is really sort of, it takes the concept addict and says, what is this? How has this historically been constructed? How have we made it so that we think that there's a group of people who it's perfectly fine to call addict and make all sorts of disparaging comments about them and decide what should happen with them? So ultimately, I think it's hard to critique drug courts because the first question is, well, what do you suggest as an alternative? But also because I think that it's very hard to start questioning what is this thing called addict in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very strong cultural concept. And so to start unpacking that, I think is in some ways the work that I'm most interested in.
Yeah, I mean, I think throughout this interview, we've sort of used the word addict
mm-hmm.
and there's a sort of irony behind using the word
mm-hmm.
addict, right? Because
yeah.
it's a social construct and
yeah.
it's a way that people, dominant society actually labels people.
Yeah.
And it's not that we are saying people are addicts.
Yeah,
yeah.
I would put a quote always in that, but
yeah.
at some point you can't.
You've got lots of rabbit ears going on.
I know, and you know, in the book I do, at some point the editor was like, you need to stop, but that's,
yeah.
when you do this kind of work, it's good to sort of, instead of say addict, period, you say addict, question mark, and you
yeah.
start to sort of think about, well, what does that mean? And I've used various things. I say habitual or mm-hmm. committed drug user. I mean, I've tried to get language from a variety of different ways of thinking about it, so that moving away from the language of addict. Conversely, there could be a movement to say, yeah, I'm an addict, and so what? So either get rid of that language,
reclaiming the term, wasn't it? Like junkie,
reclaim that. You know, people have reclaimed queer. People reclaim these mm-hmm. things that were used to disparage them. That would be an alternate movement. That's really a movement that says, listen, we're all drug users. We're in this together.
Yeah.
Let's not decide that that's a negative assessment.
Although I guess the 12-step movement has actually claimed the word addict.
They have. You're mm-hmm. right. I mean, they've claimed addict. They have. But it's not a sort of, I guess what I'm imagining is sort of reclaiming it and in the process reclaiming one's right to alter one's consciousness, sort of, which the 12-step movement hasn't really.
Right.
And, you know, I get a lot of comments about, well, people want to talk about 12-step with me often, which mm-hmm. I don't really actually talk about much in the book. But that, you know, they've actually done a lot to sort of create an idea, a notion around addiction. And I think, you know, I guess I think there maybe would be helpful to have a similar movement, but with a different framework to think about drug users. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are efforts for people to sort of claim that identity and claim it with a kind of, not even so much pride as it is what I am. But it's one of the many things mm-hmm. I am.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, Rebecca, thank you very much for this. I'm going to get you to sign my book now.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks very much to Rebecca, and thanks very much to you, and we will see you again.
Is your arm uncomfortable?
Well, I don't have any muscles in my arm.
Okay.